I then despised everything about the army. The military teaches you to dig deeper, to fight harder, to do the right thing, to have integrity. After a few months of healing, it was like, well, actually, Lara, do you think maybe you're the problem? We're going to give this another go, and we're going to go in with a different attitude this time.
Can you imagine the heart and heart just dropping?
Yeah. I was like, this is not happening a second time. The sooner you bring your personality work to work and who you really are, the less you'll spend pretending you're something you're not.
So my guest this week is Lara Small. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
Hello. Okay, so She Who Dares Wins. Can you tell me a little bit about when you might have dared and won?
Ah, okay.
Straight in there.
Wow, straight in for the kill. When have I dared and then won? I guess the immediate reflection, straight to the point, is that I dared to go motorbike racing. And to cut immediately to the point, the last time I raced at Cadwell Park earlier in October this year, I won every race that I participated in.
Amazing.
Which was a culmination of 8 or 9 years of racing effort, learning racecraft, learning what it means to battle elbow to elbow, knee to knee, fighting for the same piece of tarmac on an apex, and being absolutely focused on that finishing line, that finishing flag, and being in the first place to do it. So that's the most recent one of doing the thing, but you don't realize how much effort it takes to win a race, but then the feeling of achieving at the end of it.
It's fantastic. Yeah, I want to come on to your motorcycling, so I think it's amazing. But if you don't mind, let's just go back a little bit to, sure. I mean, your CV, I'm going to be honest with you, Lara, when I read it, I was like, wow. Like, it's pretty incredible. Start us off with your journey, if you don't mind, into the army and kind of like Sandhurst and your training.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
So how did you decide that you wanted to be in the military?
The early signs of that was joining like cadets. So when I was at school, I was born in Jersey, and they had there was a kind of an RAF cadet or an air cadet type team. I joined the cadets, and that gives you a sense of like uniform discipline, time, teamwork, marching around, you know, learning a few of the basic procedures of what it means to be in the military. That was number seven overseas air squadron, I think, in Jersey. And then, when I went to uni, a slightly delayed start, but I was around Freshers' Fair, kind of walked the wrong way around, I think. I can only describe it, looking for something to do with my free time.
Right.
And a very, very exuberant officer cadet came over to me. She was from the Army Officer Training Corps. And she convinced me that it was a good idea to join them, because you could get essentially paid as a student to learn how to be in the military, but also do the sports, any kind of sports you wanted. And so that led to being part of the officer training corps whilst I was at university. So there's units all over the UK, usually around major universities or major hubs, and you learn how to be a leader, an officer in the army whilst you're at uni. Right. So it's in conjunction with your academic studies. So they do it like a term time routine. And on Wednesday afternoons, which is normally reserved perhaps for sporting endeavours at uni, you'd then go and spend some time in the army.
Oh, wicked. Okay. And what was that like? Like, do you feel that it was like a perfect fit for you? Is it something that you always saw yourself doing, or was it something that was completely new and had kind of strange experiences with?
I don't know. I'm quite driven by structure, I think, within reason. Like, it's starting to rebel a little bit now, but what it could be at the end, like having a goal towards what I was spending my time doing, made sense. So I guess you could argue that, yeah, it was a fit, because if it isn't, I wouldn't have stayed. So that was in 2005 when I joined as a cadet.
Right.
It made sense. But when you get into the swing of things, it's your peer group, it's your relationships, it's what the military offer, it's what keeps you kind of motivated and involved, because a large part of military training involves some running around in a field, getting horrifically soaking wet, doing sentry duties, we call it stag duty, at ridiculous hours in the morning, the discipline to get out of your sleeping bag, to go and sit and look at in a field when it's utterly pissing it down, and the deeper relationships you make with the people you do it with, it breeds that sense of, well, I'm in it now, let's just keep going. And yeah, and then that more kind of perhaps reflects on my stamina to achieve things in life in general. The military teaches you to dig deeper, to fight harder, to do the right thing, to have integrity. And I think when you kind of align with all those values, it's something, a more superficial hobby might not, it wasn't as appealing to me.
Yeah, that's what one of my questions for you was going to be, you know, what skill sets or how did the military set you up for, future life? And you've answered that perfectly already.
There's probably a deeper message though with what the military would teach you, whether it's RAF or Army or the Navy, but it does in some ways, not to be horrifically cliched about it, but does break you down into some smaller pieces, because when you really find out who you truly are when you're incredibly sleep deprived and you've been in a field, I know it doesn't sound like much, but 5 days and five nights just operating out of your kit.
Right.
You're patrolling across kilometres and kilometres of undulating British countryside, but typically it's some horrid Welsh mountainside somewhere in really wet weather. And it does, how you are and how you interact with the people around you and how you pull together is a unique experience that you can do in other environments, but I think the Army do it in a kind of a safe, controlled manner, but then really explores what you turn into, because we're all different beasts when we're a bit sleepy and we haven't had access to caffeine.
Yeah. I mean, my brother actually did, you hate me for saying this, because I don't know if he finished it, but he did TA training, and when he's notoriously bad at sleeping, and he was explaining about being in a field and having to wake up, and I envied him a little bit because I thought, what a great experience. But then I realized, yeah, I absolutely love my sleep. Was there any point where you say that they kind of break you down and then build you up? Was there any particular scenario where you hit that point?
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, there's a few. there's a few. And it's something I still find hard to talk about. But in the lessons learned and how it's helped me and might help others in the future,
right.
it was a pretty major life lesson. And one of the things that you go through in the officer training corps is you kind of time it with your academic years. So you do, let's say your degree is like a 3-year degree. You learn in your first year in the Army how to operate in the field as a soldier, like look after yourself, use a weapon, look after yourself in the kit, maintain personal hygiene, use the rations and equipment that they issue you with. And then the second year is like a theory of leadership and how to move a group of people across the ground in order to inevitably defeat an enemy position. So it's kind of like the maneuverist approach, but that's in some cases the direct impact of the Army, and they do it in a controlled manner. So it's 30 people, you take it in turns to manage those 30 people, groups of three, and you learn the theory of how to move people safely across the ground from A to enemy, and do it effectively in order to preserve life. And then third year is doing it all together. So you combine your soldiering skills along with the theory of moving along the ground. You do it out in the field. So you keep repeating that, which is basically avoiding what we call blue on blue, but kind of aiming fire at your mates,
right?
Which is generally not welcome. So you do that, and then you would get assessed as a leader. So your ability to command and control a group of people on the ground in what is a preparatory and then very hectic environment when the simulated battle rounds are applied, because we all have blanks in our weapons, right. And they use enemy positions to infer fire upon us. And, you know, life gets very busy and intense at that moment, and you get to find out what kind of leader you are and how capable you are.
Right.
So it's a great opportunity, actually, but in a safe environment. But you've got to bear in mind that you're then very tired, your kit needs to be prepared and sorted, and you've got to be prepared to run around a bit and avoid getting shot at. So the they train you to do that over the three or four years you might spend at uni, and then you can go and finish off the job at Sandhurst, Royal Military Academy of Sandhurst, which is like a verification where you learn, you just get verified by the staff team at Sandhurst who wish to make sure that you've achieved a certain standard. And as a result of that, you get commissioned into the army. So apart from doing some what we call platoon tactics that I've just described, you get assessed in terms of how good you are as a leader and whether you deserve to hold the now King's Commission. Because I'm very goal orientated, I went to Sandhurst, which involved obviously 3 years of training, quite an intense exercise in the field as preparatory readiness for Sandhurst. And then you do another 4 weeks at Sandhurst as a reservist. And you go through what you'd imagine is quite rigorous. Well, you go right from basics. You're all in kind of corridors and halls, and you need to prepare for the next day, and it involves a lot of ironing, a lot of preparing your room for inspection, and preparing to go out into the field, for example, and you get assessed for those 4 weeks. And it's quite an intense task. Can be quite intimidating. There's about 100 or so of you to kind of get through, similar to like the regular course. The regulars would do that for a year, whereas we do almost like all the preparatory work before we arrive, and then you get assessed on those final 4 weeks. And there's another 5 day exercise, which, and I don't want to sound glib, but it's not easy. It's deliberately not easy. And you're doing platoon attack after platoon attack after platoon attack, and constantly rotating around different roles between soldier, kind of intermediate leader, section commander of a team of eight or so. And then you take it in turns to roll through the platoon command a bit, which we all enjoy. And it got through to the last phase of it, and we're all called into like a room, and we're all quite excited because my parents had come to my house to celebrate my commissioning after the time in at Sandhurst, and a few names got called out out of the 100 or so. There's two or three names, of one of which was mine, and I got made to like stay behind in this room to listen to what was an extra message, as it were, for me and a few others. And the impact of that was I'd basically failed at Sandhurst. And it was a huge blow, because it wasn't just like a 4 weeks of effort. It feels like I'd been kicked from 4 years of effort to get to that point of achieving a commission. And it probably is quite normal behavior, I then despised everything about the army.
Totally. I'd be with you on that.
I was like, you know, the table flip of, well,
this is shit.
I haven't asked you if swearing's allowed.
It's totally allowed. Yeah. You go for it.
Yeah. So the army could go basically. And you know, the kind of sense of utter despair of like, because you know, it's your whole little world. And I was like mid-20s, I guess, and it was my first real sense of absolute failure of an institution that I'd wanted to achieve, like the cherry on top of going to Sandhurst for. And I hadn't envisaged a career in the army. It was just something that I wanted to make good out of the years I'd spent in the officer training course. It was like, it makes sense to finish off the job. I was very, very reticent, and I was really angry about the kind of the people around me, the directing staff. Why didn't they, I don't know, help me along the way or tell me what was wrong or what was it that I'd missed? And why is it that I'd failed? And very much blaming the system, which on reflection turned into significant life lessons.
Right.
Because when you realize that you basically, after a few months of healing, it was like, well, actually, Lara, do you think maybe you're the problem and not this massive institution that's got an incredible good track record of developing leaders? I think maybe you might be the issue here, not the the institution that we know as a military that's been operating for many, many centuries. And I realized that actually, Lara, you screwed up here. You weren't a team player. You weren't the one helping people around you when it was time to get ready for like the next day, or how you were pulling in as a team player for the platoon commander. How were you supporting others around you? Were you just kind of squaring yourself away and not playing the game, not leaning in to help others?
Right.
I was perhaps more interested in doing the leadership position and not enough of the serving position, which is how you pull as a soldier and how you help people around you.
Right.
I was selfish. And the way the army kind of, strips you down into little pieces and builds you back up again is how I felt like that happened. And so I just had a good hard look at what I was.
Yeah, I mean, is that like, yeah, that is one hell of a life experience, especially like you say in your 20s where you don't have necessarily the skill set to navigate that, which you did on reflection now, like come to the point where you understood it. Like when they told you that, is there any opportunity? Is it just a fail and pass? Is there any opportunity to carry on, or what is it? Literally, the ship sailed.
Yeah.
Wow.
As in not permanently. I don't know how many attempts you are allowed at Sandhurst. Being one to fight process, you keep going. But if this kind of is or isn't right for you. And by Sandhurst, obviously, that's a Royal Military Leadership Academy or Royal Military Academy. So you can go back. So after me hating the system out of the kind of stoic attitude, I was like, actually, I think I'm going to give this another go.
Right.
Which already felt, and I can feel that intake of breath of how much pressure I'd then gone, right, let's go back. And
yeah,
I knew what was coming. And that involved doing this another 5-day exercise before even making it back to Sandhurst. Like it all expired, as it were, my validation. So I had to kind of restart, not completely at the beginning, but at least another year's worth of preparation.
Right.
I was like, right, we're going to give this another go. And we're going to go in with a different attitude this time. And I think I made a promise to myself that you were going to be a team player and you were going to work on this. And I'm not going to lie, I still wasn't perfect. You can't just suddenly fix altruism.
Error, yeah.
And tired Lara is still tired Lara. But fortunately, tired Lara has an inbuilt do you think you could just help someone else? Do you think you can push a bit harder to just lean in and help others? Yes, you can. Come on, get a grip. Let's go. And so that turned into a more awareness of myself and how I behaved around others and how I could help others. And so I think it was 2011-ish or a little bit later on, I was like, I got through to that same room of this kind of arduous military training. And I'd been more aware of, you're not just going to be in your room this time, you're going to help others. You know what's coming next. And I was too embarrassed to tell people I'd been there twice.
Right. Howdy, folks. Sorry to interrupt this amazing podcast, but I just have a short message from this week's awesome podcast sponsors, GT85. The GT85 spray is the best kept secret for cleaning, lubing and protecting. It's endorsed and used by cyclists, DIYers, tradespeople and mechanics. Tried and tested since 85, GT85 is a proven formula with multiple uses. It's an ideal tool for every garage, workshop, and toolbox. It's a trusted brand both at home and at work, and it gets the job done. With its professional strength and water displacing properties, you can expect long-lasting lubrication and protective shine that leaves a great overall finish. GT85 is recommended for lubing, cleaning and maintaining all types of bicycles, motorcycles, engines, car parts, tools and heavy duty machinery. Protecting surfaces against dirt and rust, driving out moisture from electrical systems, loosening stuck parts and ultimately bringing the shine back to metal, chrome and plastic surfaces. I want to say a massive thanks to GT85 for sponsoring this podcast. Let's get back to it.
But there's a lot of late night laminating. The army love laminating maps. Big fan of that. But fighting with rolls and rolls of sticky back plastic, but A3 size. Right. You just get yourself wrapped up in it. and there's creases everywhere all over your maps. And there was just a few things that I was like, right, I think I can help the people in my dormitory, as it were, how we can get stuff done. And then in the field, just like, my kit was all sorted. Who else needs help? Who needs their food cooking for them? Who needs a brew? Who needs like some time weapon cleaning? Like just lean in and help others.
Right.
And so I still wasn't perfect, but I made it through. So we're in that final room. But my name got called out again, which freaked me out.
Oh my God.
I was like, my heart, you can imagine the heart, my heart just dropping. Yeah. I was like, this is not happening a second time. And ended up marching down the same corridor. And you can imagine all the memories just flooding back of like, no. And I braced up and then saluted the officer commanding of our platoon. And all he did was just reach out and shake my hand and just said, we know you're here. You're here a second time and well done. And you'll be commissioning. And it went from the previous like year ago where everyone had come to my house to celebrate my commission. And I'd come home failed, right. You know, even though mum and dad inevitably are very proud of everything Lara does. But it felt great to come back and go and hold this. You get a pip as a first lieutenant. No, sorry, second lieutenant. You can know the ranks by now. Second lieutenant, single pip, one pip wonder. And to feel that rank on my chest, I was like, it's just such an amazing sense of relief and really proud to have finally... finished what I started.
Yeah.
I just perhaps did it the long way around.
Well, the long way around, or like, I'm a firm believer that everything happens for a reason. And ask me that when I fail and I'll disagree, but...
it hurts at the time.
It does. And it's like, I've said to people before on the podcast and in conversations that like, I do, and it's hard to say this, like I do firmly believe that people need to fail. And like actually failing in your 20s is the best time to fail.
Yeah.
And like continue to fail. Like I think if we have this fear of failing, we just never learn anything. Yours obviously was quite extreme in that the time frame that you put in was huge. But what would you, like how would you sum up that fear of, that experience in failure and then what it taught you?
Okay. It taught me one of the army-isms is a mantra called serving to lead. So if you have aspirations to lead or make something, not so leadership as such, but you want to achieve things, you don't do it on your own and you do it through a collective effort of the people around you.
Mm.
And so serving to lead means looking after others along that journey and doing what you can to help. And that can be as close as it is to you and your best mate or you and your mates or you and your partner. It's how you work together as a team to achieve something individually or collectively, I think. And that ended up giving me more of an appreciation of what I could be capable of with the support of others.
Yeah, yeah.
And having, I think another positive outcome of it was a few years later, about 5 or so years later, I think, I got moved to Bristol with work. So I came back to the Bristol Officer Training Corps because I was at uni at the University of West of England, Bristol. But I came back as a member of staff because obviously I'd commissioned and then I'd pushed on with my career in the army in Derby and near Nottingham where I lived. And I came back as a staff member and able to work with the Officer Training Corps and see the development of the officer cadets like I was. And there was an opportunity that I'd not been that great at when I was at OTC, which was something called Cambrian Patrol, which is a international military exercise over the Cambrian Mountains in Wales, like Brecon Beacon kind of area.
Right.
And there's a, you do it over, we typically as a reservist, we do it over the weekend, but it's a kind of a 48-hour exercise, which throws in, I don't know how many grounds, how much, we must have covered about 60K or something, but it's like, it's a patrol with, I don't know, 20, 30 kilograms of kit and a rifle. And you do like this protracted mission where you have to do some like model make, prepare orders, wear like kind of gas protection systems in the event of chemical attack, which, as you can imagine, running around and breathing in that is quite tricky. And then river crossings and minefield clearances and vehicle and aircraft reconnaissance. And it's an intense patrol activity. And I had a crack at some of the training when I was a student at Bristol OTC. And I didn't, you know, all the kind of early errors of not being a team player had kind of kicked in then.
Right.
It's not just like military training. It pushes you a little bit further. Than what you might get as a student. But I came back as a staff member of Bristol OTC and I was like, right, what'd be really good is if we did an all-female team for this. and arguably, I'm a fundamental believer that mixed teams perform better. It's just that at the time, I was like, I was perhaps intimidated by what I thought was a male team having a woman on their team. I was like, I wonder if we can just do it if we're all women and how is that going to work out? And so I created a team of about 12 of us, and you need 8 in total. And we just started training for this patrol and allocating people to different roles. We had an ex-Olympic, like an almost Olympic rower. She was our radio operator, which is amazing. And so she carried like more kit, but she was so tall and strong. It was awesome. Right. And we had the actual like patrol commander. She was so academically gifted, but so driven and so diligent with how to do it properly and right that she kept us all in check. We had an amazing we call them point men in the army, but point woman, as it were. So she was our phenomenal navigator, and she just did loads of walking all over the peaks for fun anyway, so she was a great navigational aid. And we ended up doing this patrol as an all-female team and ended up getting a silver medal at the final ceremony, and we're now the highest performing all-female team ever to have completed Cambrian Patrol. And we still have that, as in you get bronze, silver or gold and a certificate if you didn't quite make one of the medal categories. And obviously there's a variety of bronze, silvers and gold issued to everyone who competes. And it is an international team, so it's about 100 teams or so compete every year. And we're still unbeaten in the kind of our sense of achievement. Wow. I need to stop knocking this microphone.
That's fine.
and that was, you know, because of the kind of failure I had with the army, I then knew that I could achieve more things with that kind of life lesson.
Yeah.
And have kind of made my mark in the sand along with the brilliant group of women around me. So 8 of us. And I say we started at 12. On the last selection exercise, I still had 10 people that wanted to do it.
Wow.
And it's just such a great sign of resilience in the women that opted for that opportunity and that challenge.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's 2 great comeback stories there. Obviously the comeback of you going back and then, you know, achieving what you did, and then that with an all women group is amazing. And that's why I guess the story is to get back up and keep going and keep trying.
It really is. If your focus and that sense of achievement and visualizing it, as much as I started off this conversation with visualizing winning, everything points towards that, no matter how long or short that particular task is.
Yeah, whether it's a roller coaster, well, it always will be a roller coaster of emotions along the way. And yeah, I was actually going to ask you about, so obviously me working predominantly, 17 years in construction and it being male dominated, you know, motorcycling, the army, and I'm guessing you're in the engineering field, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Very, very, very male-dominated fields. And it's weird, isn't it, how I meet people that I really relate to that are in male-dominated careers. And it seems that, for me anyway, I've been drawn to those kind of things, whether it's sport or career-wise. Have you loved kind of being in that arena of being, there's not that many women, the challenges that come with that. Or if you, you know, I speak to a lot of women, they're like, actually, there's not a lot of challenges. Like I've just seen it as a normal job. Like how, like, what are your thoughts on I guess being a woman in a male dominated world?
There's loads of opinions about on this. One of them is, I really like the private toilets. There's never...
hands down. And like, there's definitely a Portaloo chat that's been on this podcast that is like just the simple basics. Isn't it amazing? We don't want, you know, we don't want a huge amount, just a nice clean toilet.
It's just like when I have to queue for a toilet, I'm like, what's going on? Why? It's mine. So... I lost my train of thought now.
No, it's a necessity that.
I've not particularly. In fact, it's almost, dare I say, it's almost like the opposite. So I think I've adapted my behaviors to be more macho, or more to have what I'd perceive as more masculine language or more of a masculine sense of humor. But that might have just been me anyway. And I think. I wasn't sure if I would almost be more intimidated if it was all female.
Yeah, I get that.
If I'm going to be honest with myself.
Yeah. Do you think that's because, I've often thought about that and people have asked me, do you think that's because you've just been in the world for so long that it would be so different? I mean, weirdly enough, I went to an all-girls school.
Same.
Weird.
Yeah. Same.
And I had friends at school, like I still got a lot of female friends, but in a work environment, I've never really worked a lot with females and have thrived, I guess, and really enjoyed working with males. As long, you know, there's this stark, I always say there's like 90% is incredible and there's this 10% that's really dark and bad, which is always need to be open for discussion. But yeah, it's, I often wonder, is it a conditioning? I've experienced the same as you in that I adopted, especially in construction, to kind of survive this kind of male persona of the talk, the how you hold yourself. Like I never wore makeup to work. Mm. And I think back now, I wonder how it would, or even if it would have been, you know, different if I'd have got a job which would have, you know, involved being with a lot of women. Do you feel like the same? Like, you feel like... do you think you would always gravitate towards?
I think it's not really who is doing it. It's more of my passion for what it is.
Right. Okay.
So it just so happens that I've chosen passions that are currently perceived as male dominated.
Right. Okay.
And therefore I've got on with, because therefore the connection with the people that like that thing is irrelevant of their gender or however they identify.
Yeah.
So I like engineering. It's currently in the UK, it's male dominated, but there's phenomenally other cultures in the world that have a matriarchal society that might be equally passionate about a thing. And therefore I'd be passionate about it, whoever was involved. So, and the army, is actually, there's a really positive ratio, particularly in the officer cadet arena. And then it gets a bit more niche and a bit gender swung, in certain, environments, but like say in the Royal Engineers, for example, there's still a heavy balance of men versus women, but there's a whole massive debate about how we influence our children and the careers, and they're influenced by the media and pink stuff versus blue stuff and how the teachers perceive it and how we're advertised to, blah, blah, blah. So there's a lot of people that have been put off inadvertently, a lot of women being put off inadvertently by it. One of the things I think I'm welcoming more and realizing in myself, instead of me adapting to what I think is a, I keep saying machoistic. I can't remember the right word for it, but I have more fun now bringing my own language to describe something. I remember like when I was doing my year in industry at Rolls Royce, I think I'd use the word like shiny to talk about a metal object. It was particularly titanium that we were cold rolling, and it became, when you flatten the surface, it became shinier, you know. And I think I used the word shiny to describe it, which my manager at the time was like, it's not shiny, it's an improved reflective surface. I was like, shiny. Like, and I wanted to like have a softer language. I know shiny isn't soft, but it's kind of, it was a, that's the language I want to use to describe it. And the being, I think if I want to, use something that might be a more rounded way to describe something, I will now, rather than going, oh, corporately, I think you'll find that it's, it's a compressed structure. Can't think off the cuff to describe that in an engineering term right now. But yes, I think it's just celebrating my language and how I wanted to be involved in that way.
And feeling comfortable in the space. Yeah. And just, I think, like you say, bringing who you are to a role and not trying to fit what people think you should be. I feel like that comes with experience. Like, I feel like I had to do that to get to the point where I'm like, whoa, hold on a minute. This, like, I could just turn up and be me. I think I've said this before, like, my husband was like, leave your balls at the door after coming in and like shouting and it's just like, you are influenced by the world that you're in, but you also control and not lose yourself. And I think I lost myself on the journey, but came back full circle to being like, no, where is Michelle? Like, here she is. It's really interesting chatting to people like yourself that are in that world, and there's a lot of common themes that we all come across, the toilet being one of them. I love the fact that you said the leadership was kind of an issue and the thing that you ultimately failed on at Sandhurst, and now you are a leader.
Mm.
Your job is to lead.
In many ways,
which is so perfect. So let's touch a little bit on, before we get into the absolute badass motorcycling stuff.
Which again is another example of leadership.
So this bit in between then, what I said, you're still working for...
So I work for Rolls-Royce. Engineering manager there. And I'm now a major in the army, which is like a reasonably senior officer-ish. Mm-hmm. And so the kind of, I've pursued both careers basically.
Right. Oh, awesome. That's amazing. So you've got two that kind of like run alongside each other, and the skill set I imagine across the two is just like...
more blended than you think.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that rather than the earlier stuff where I talked to you about what would be quite dictatorial leadership language of how to get, like how to operate under enemy fire in a field, you know, in an enemy, in a kind of a conflict environment. A lot of the time as a reservist, it's the softer skills that make a huge difference, because no one really turns up to be shouted at.
Yeah.
It's just so much more influence and careful, persuasive opportunities to work together rather than I'm telling you to do this, so you're going to do it.
Yeah. Do you have many women on your team that you lead it within your job?
Oh, at Rolls-Royce, yes. There is a better balance. And sometimes we end up in a meeting room and I look around and I'm like, oh, it's 50-50. We made it.
Yes. Take that.
It's the engineering side. It's just still a little bit squiffed, but it is genuinely getting better.
Yeah. Yes. And I think that goes across the board for most industries, which is amazing. Are there any of those like younger women that you can see yourself in, and that what I'm trying to get here to is, what are key themes that the younger people coming through, younger girls coming through, are feeling? Is it kind of like, you know, imposter syndrome? I'm hoping that there's an evolution of the next generation coming through, feel a little bit more empowered and a little bit more okay with, I'm here because of, I'm supposed to be here, rather than I'm here because I'm a woman and been put in this position to, you know, build up a statistic. Mm. And how they fare alongside male colleagues.
I've got the luxury of being allocated to a few mentees at work.
Cool.
To kind of help them along their way. And more of the earlier conversations is just them being like, there's a lot to learn. Where do I start?
Right.
And what, I haven't really picked up any major vulnerabilities. I've just tried to show them that the sooner you bring your personality to work and who you really are, the less you'll spend pretending you're something you're not.
Yeah. Because the energy that's like expending in that is huge. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you do your job when you're also trying to be someone else.
Like. Yeah, you're totally distracted. My brother, who's gay, I remember speaking to him about it about a decade ago or something. I was like, he was really adamant that he wanted to bring about more awareness at work for his sexuality. And I was like, why bother? Like, it doesn't matter what people know or think. But he was like, I have to put energy into guarding what I say I'm doing at the weekend. So instead of saying I went out on a date night with my boyfriend, he'll go, I hung out with my friend instead.
Yeah.
And it's that energy and that conscious endeavor to disguise what you're doing in your free time in order to avoid what you think would be a like derogative opinion of you, or a kind of controversial opinion. It's an energy that you shouldn't have to waste at work. You need to just bring yourself and being around people that understand who you are and what value you add. And the same way anyone going to work who has to hide who they really are is you're not fully involved. You're not the real you at your work environment or your home life or your family environment or your friends or hobbies. You can't be yourself.
Yeah.
So if you can't, if you're not happy to bring yourself at work, I know we're going down a separate work agenda, but maybe that workplace isn't right for you.
Yeah.
because they're not opening and open enough to help you be you.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is, I think there's a scale, isn't there? I completely agree with you. And actually quite recently I was listening to a podcast and it was the author Robert Greene. And he actually goes against that and talks about how you should, you know, being different at work is okay because work is a very different environment that you need to survive and play by the rules by. But I think in the general context, what he means is, you know, you can't, if you love, you know, dancing around at home and doing silly stuff, you're not going to bring that to work. So I think it's finding that balance, isn't it? Of being yourself and being authentic. And then also knowing kind of the industry that you're in and what works and what doesn't work.
True.
And playing the field a little bit. But yeah, that's good to hear. And I do hear that engineering, I think construction is a little bit far behind. I still think we're running at the 1% on site.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which is bad. But I mean, yeah, I've got opinions on why that is. And I think it can be changed. I think it's this chicken and the egg. You know, like we need to see more women, but to see more women, we need women to kind of endure what's there at the moment and change the culture as we go along.
Yeah.
Which is probably the same for most industries, but yeah, I mean, I could talk for hours on that. And this is about you. So your motorcycling, take me into how, I mean, I say like, how do you get into that? But it's kind of, it seems obvious to me.
Oh, yeah, I was born and belong on a bike.
Right.
And the more I think about that now, what am I, 37, 38, can't remember. The more I think about it, the more like this, it's just obvious.
Right. Like, from a young age though, did I read right that you were kind of put on a bike or a moped quite young?
Yeah. My dad deeply regrets that.
Oh no.
Deeply regrets that. Yep. He's brought a moped home that he'd found in a dump, like a dumpster, and it still ran. It was just something that the owner wanted to get rid of. It's like this beige 49cc Yamaha Pesola with a basket and a box. I took the basket off and on the box I'd written, if I could go faster, I would. And then rode it around my garden at 15. And prior to that, I'd like hung around on a bicycle and I'd put like a flapper on the back of the spokes that made like a motorbike noise. And it was obsessed with being on two wheels. And so 15, I was riding around the garden. And then 16, you get a CBT and they can take it on the road. And it's just that immediate sense of freedom, not being stuck in a box.
Yeah. The wind in your hair, quite literally, and the speed and the, yeah. And so how do you get into, obviously, the career in the army and then your job at Rock? When did this kind of hobby kind of overtake? I know, you know, you race and you win.
Do win stuff.
Yeah, this is amazing.
So apart from just early days, when I was like 17, I had a couple of bikes. Going to uni meant I couldn't afford it or didn't need it. Like uni in a big city, you didn't need that kind of method of transport. But I did work at uni in Bristol for a company called Scooterman.
Right.
I think they must be still called Scooterman. But it always quite funny when I'd arrive at a customer's car and take my helmet off and they're like, oh, you're a girl. I was like, yes, I am. So this is a motorbike courier service. So right. You ride a small monkey bike to a client's car. You put the car in the you put the bike in their car, and then you drive them home. So typically they've been out drinking, but they drive to the destination, and instead of getting a taxi back, they get their car back.
Wow, this is is that still going?
I need to check. It operates best in major cities, London and Bristol being one of them. A couple of them, but I don't know. I haven't checked online recently. But you basically strip this 90cc motorbike down. And that was my part-time job at uni, which was the best thing I could have ever had, because that's basically cutting about on this little 90, in through Bristol city centre, probably highly dangerous, but getting in the way of taxis, fighting traffic, trying to go as fast as I could behind high rise trucks, on a motorway.
Whoa.
Not a motorway, but an A road, wherever you're not allowed to take it on. trying to get as fast as I could on these little 90s. Even when it was raining, because the spark plug was slightly forward of the cylinder, it would get waterlogged, and you'd be fighting your way home, just listening to this poor thing drowning. You're like, stay alive. and that was a great university job. I think I had a couple of times. Oh yeah. So one time I took my helmet off, and I just had this guy look at me like, you're going to drive my car. I was like, yes. I mean, legally, I really should. And then was always quite funny, but I would get challenged with a little bit of parking. So you'd have to come to someone's home, and then they'd tell you to drop them off along the road outside. I'm like, no, this is your car. It needs to go in your driveway. I'm not a taxi, because people would forget that.
Oh, that you were. Oh my God.
But then I'd park it, and they're like, oh, my wife's never been able to do that. And that's just funny. But then the wife sat in the back, burning daggers into the husband's back of the neck. But it was a really, really good job. Apart from one scenario where there was a chap next to me who basically hadn't pulled all night, hadn't pulled where the lights had come on, and decided to then hit on the last female that was in his life on that day. I was like, this isn't going to work out, mate. I'm just going to drop you off now.
Yeah, you're done. Oh my, yeah, I imagine that there's quite a fair few stories. That sounds like an incredibly fun job.
It was a brilliant, brilliant job. But that kind of, riding bikes. And then when I had a little bit more cash, and I'd gone out the grad scheme at Rolls Royce, I bought a Honda CBR 600F, which is like a sports tourer, and then started doing some longer distances stuff around the peaks and further north. And then I took that on track days. So a track day is where you can ride around a track, basically, with whatever bike you ride up on. And you just get to explore within a safer, more controlled environment, what you can really do on a bike. A lot of people are intimidated by track days, but actually it's a much better way to kind of push your limits and on the road.
Yeah.
It's one-way traffic. It's a lot clearer. There's marshals and medics on every corner, and you can lean over a bit more and see what it really means to accelerate and use your brakes without oil, sheep, back of tractors, and difficult roads. So that led to an observation from one of the instructors on the day to go, how did you learn to ride like that? I was like, I don't know, that's just how I ride. So basically I was at Mallory Park pulling super, but not drastic. I've looked at the pictures and my body position is terrible, but just basically overtaking everyone on my, I was this novice in a high-vis vest with the rack still on the back of the bike.
Awesome.
On this sports tour. Why is everyone going so slow? and that led to a little bit of a state of realizing that Lara loves corners and the feeling of being in one. I don't know if you can kind of relate it to skiing a little bit,
yeah,
or maybe the flow of, or surfing, but just the sense of being totally in the moment. I know it's ridiculous because you're just going around a corner. You're just literally running around in a circle on tarmac. But that sense of feeling of the bike moving under you and just driving the power out and looking for that apex. Oh, it's just bliss to me. And so that, you connect with that sense of adrenaline, that sense of focus, a sense of meditation in a way,
yeah,
that I wanted to do more of it. And a friend of mine was like, well, why don't we do more of it? Let's go racing. I was like, okay.
And so the racing was born.
Yeah, she got a van. I bought a Honda CB500, which is a 50 horsepower, 500cc twin. It's a commuter bike. So it's a run-of-the-mill commuter. It's really easy to kind of crash and repair. It's not a race bike. It's a converted road bike. And it's a great way to learn how to race because it's not about horsepower. It's about corner speed and racecraft.
Right.
It doesn't have any fairing. You kind of have to tuck behind the dials and you learn what it means to race without too much money against people on the same bike. So it's not really about horsepower. It's about rider skill.
Yeah.
And I did my first race at Brands Hatch. I don't know, it must have been about 2017-ish maybe. And I was me and 39 other people on the start line at Brands Hatch, and the lights were all on red and you open up the throttle to whatever kind of rev count you wanted, and just the hum and the thunder of all these bikes, and I was like, oh shit, I'm in a race. And then the lights drop out and you're all hairing into Paddock Hill Bend and then firing up to the hairpin and back round, and I got through and I was like, I'm not dead, this is happening, I'm racing a motorbike, this is crazy. And then it was just, and I wasn't last, I was like, oh okay, right, this is good. I was mid-pack and just, I was like, right, I'm finally racing. And that was
I can almost feel the adrenaline that you go through with those emotions. So how many women riders are there? Is it a mixed race?
It's a mixed race, but there weren't too many of us in single figures. But every time I go to a race meet, there's more coming through.
That's good. And the winning seems to be something that you're very good at.
Recently, yes. But it's taken a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to do that.
Any
sure.
bad accidents, like
inevitably,
but not enough for you to be like the, you know.
Yeah, so there's 2 or 3% where mistakes have been made. But one thing I think I really want to change the narrative on bike riding is that people don't immediately ask the question, and if you fall into that classic trap of, tell me about your best bits of riding. People always go with, oh, have you crashed yet? I really wish we could talk about
like, the adrenaline and the what it gives
back
to
you. What was your favorite corner? Why is it your favorite corner? Yeah. Like, have you ever got your elbow down? And to celebrate the wins where I've had more fun mid-pack chasing people, doing these amazing overtakes and having a really good battle, and that sense of getting it all perfect. That's what I want to celebrate about riding, and that sense of freedom. But yeah, of course I've crashed many, many times. So I can only... I can count to 9 3/4 now because I lost the tip of that little finger.
Oh, that for most likely?
Cold tires, yeah. Wow. I just made a mistake at Gooseneck and just lopped the end off. That was fun.
Oh.
I'm currently just recovering from a dislocated shoulder. So made a mess of that at Cadwell Park. But the rest of it has all been pretty harmless, to be honest. Wear the right kit. There's airbag systems you can buy now that sit under your leathers, and they're great bits of kit. Run on GPS and kind of an accelerometer, so it recognizes when you've perhaps shifted away from the intended target line. And so there's loads of really good kit you can have on a bike now to help with that impact damage.
Yeah. And where do you see yourself kind of, I hate this question, sound like a job question. Where do you see yourself in 5 years? But your career has evolved so much and you've done incredible things. Like I said at the start, I read through your CV and was like, wow, like the awards and everything that you've achieved so far. What's kind of in the future? What do you see?
Yeah, so I actually, it's becoming clearer now. So in the Venn diagram, of my life, and it's underpinned by the fourth big old circle of family and friends, because they underpin everything. And so I think it's really important that I shift my focus on that network just as much as the kind of things that Lara likes to do.
Yeah.
So the first one, from a engineering or Rolls-Royce point of view, I've got a lot on. I'm really proud of what the company does and delivers and how we're making a difference. So I've got a general focus, not up the career ladder, but just to deliver what I said I was going to do and help that part of the business I work in. So I'm really proud of that and what we do. The army side of things, again, there's lots of opportunities to develop others now in the rank I'm in. And so I'm going to be focusing on on that, teaching others, helping us on that leadership journey, and contributing to one of the softer skills of the military mission. It's not all about what I've described in terms of weapons and firepower. There's more influence we can make in the army. So that's kind of progressing nicely. So they're kind of simmering over.
Nice.
The bike one is taking more of a precedent now. So I have started moving into like a more of a journalism world. So there's three main areas in which I've developed that. So one, I work for a company called Bike World, which is a worldwide YouTube channel and TV production.
Right.
And so I film bike releases and launches and reviews with that company, and really proud to work with my presenters there. I also filmed a motorbike TV with a much smaller company down in Wales, Swansea, called Woodrose. Worth having a quick look. So it's a chap that's starting up his own like motorbike clothing and bike selling business. So really proud to work with him. And then finally, I've started writing. So I've penned an article for Fast Bikes magazine.
Nice.
And so I'm just kind of using my free time just to explore what it means to represent capable riding. I just happen to be female, but just basically doing my thing. And hopefully inspiring others, anyone, to come and join the world of motorbiking.
And I think you'll do that. You've been incredibly inspiring to me. Like, yeah. And I think you have so much to give, and you are giving, whether it's those that you work with or just by, you know, coming in and speaking and letting others hear your story. It's very inspiring and empowering. So I want to say thank you so much for coming today. You've been an absolute awesome guest.
It's been an absolute pleasure.